Good afternoon. The time is 2 o'clock. Welcome to Vox Pop for this Wednesday, November 3rd. I'm Ray Graff. The coin and stamp experts are back for another hour of calls from all of you collectors out there. Bob Scott and David Tripp join us. If you're enthusiastic about coins and or stamps, you'll want to give us a call. 800-348-2551. 1-800-348-2551. Maybe you found an old candy tin with very rare coins. You know, it's happened. It really has, and we'll talk about it. We'll find out if you're interested in that, and we'll do that right away. 800-348-2551 is our number. Email your questions to voxpop@wamc.org. Stamps and coins coming up after the news. Hello again. Welcome back to Vox Pop, WAMC's live afternoon call-in talk show. I'm Ray Graff. Collectors, this is the moment we've been waiting for. We welcome back our stamp and coin experts. First is David Tripp. He's the former director of Sotheby's Coin Tapestry at Musical Instrument Departments. He's author of Illegal Tender, Gold Greed at the Mystery of the Lost, 1933 Double Eagle, as well as a fine art consultant and a cartoonist of note. Also joining us this afternoon is Bob Scott. He was a curator to a private collection, senior technical specialist at Christie's, and head of the stamp departments at both Sotheby's and Bonhams. He is currently a private consultant whose clients include Sotheby's, for whom he cataloged the world's most valuable stamp. The number to call here if you have a stamp or coin question is 800-348-2551, 1-800-348-2551, or you can email us at voxpop@wamc.org. David and Bob, welcome back to Sumptuous Studio A.
It's wonderful to be home again.
Doesn't it look exactly the same?
No, the chairs have changed.
Oh, the chairs are nicer.
Yes, they are. Yeah, They're actually more comfortable.
They go up and they go down. Not for long.
I mean, and of course, we're here.
It's great to have you both here. I mean, what could go wrong now, right?
Well, we've still got 50 minutes. We can find out.
Oh, well, that we will. Once again, if you would like to join the disaster, give us a call, 800-348-2551. This bit about the coins found in the tin just blows my mind. Now, you just brought these pictures in, so they're not on our website. I don't even think we own them, so I can't put them on there.
I can ask the people who took them and
maybe
and
for next time.
Or I'll just send them, and we can...
But describe it for us. This is incredible.
It is a little tin can, a tin that chocolates would have been put in. This is in England.
Right.
And they were brought in to an auction, a local auction house in London. And I know the guys there, nice bunch of guys.
Blunts.
And they opened up the tin, and which has got this wonderful picture on the outside, really cheesy 1940s, 1950s look of a guy wearing a dinner jacket and the whole nine yards. Putting a wrap on a lovely lady.
Yeah.
And he opened it up, and there is this jumble of coins. And there's junk, there's double junk. And then his eyes started to go around, and he saw some just amazing things. The most exciting one was this really boring-looking piece of silver, about the size of a quarter, half as thick.
Yeah.
And on one side, it's got just the letters N-E, and on the other side, it's got Roman numeral 12. That's it.
Okay.
Okay. But he instantly recognized it. He said, I can't believe it's real. He checked it and double-checked it. It is an example of the first coin made in what is now the United States. It was made in Boston. The record still exists between May and October of 1652.
Wow.
So it is America's first coin. It's called a New England shilling. They know where it was made. They know who made it, when it was made. The mint it was made in was 10 by 16 feet.
Hmm. Slightly larger than this studio.
Only minimally.
Yes.
But it's such a plain design. It was not made for very long because it was too easy to forge. It was too easy to make copies.
So how do you know it's not a forgery?
Well, they checked it. They sent it off for weight. They sent it to one of these slabbing services we talk about, the third-party grading services.
Would you send something potentially so valuable to a grading service? Wouldn't you?
You have to. Some people won't buy them unless they've been graded. Some major buyers will not buy them unless graded.
So what if it gets lost in the mail?
That's called
it
insurance.
It doesn't go in the mail, at least it stays in the mail for a long time.
And it's insured. And it came back not only as genuine, but the finest example in existence.
Wow.
It's the only one that was graded to be in mint condition. There are about 40 to 50 of them in existence. Most of them are in museums. And this one is...
What's the value?
Pre-sale estimate, do you want it in pounds or dollars?
Oh, gosh, both.
Okay, 150 to 200,000 pounds.
Well, that's not that bad.
$200,000 to $300,000.
Okay.
It could bring more. But that wasn't all he found.
No.
In the same tin were two coins dated 1776, which are called continental currency. They're based, the earliest design. They're traditionally, nobody really knows quite when they were made. And then there was a medal that was designed and executed and paid for in France by Benjamin Franklin.
Ooh.
With Libertas Americana, and it is celebrating the victories at Yorktown and Saratoga, so it has local interest to
very
us.
Very interesting.
It's and they were all in a little tin.
Okay, and it's a nice little tin.
And the tin, I don't know if they're selling the tin separately.
But, I mean, how did they get this? Somebody just came in and said, found this.
This is the best part. This is one of these stories that, you know, it's the old artichoke. You keep peeling it back and it gets better and better. They said, okay, your name, his name was Wentworth Beaumont. It was the name of the owner.
Okay.
Okay, Wentworth Beaumont is the ancestor of a guy called John Wentworth who came to America in 1636.
He missed the Mayflower.
He missed the Mayflower, but even better, his family were, included in his family, was the Lieutenant Governor of New Hampshire and the Colonial Governor of New Hampshire and Massachusetts.
Wow.
So the theory is these were actually collected at the time they were made and simply descended in the family. And because in the same little tin, there are coins that were made in the 17th century in England during the Civil Wars in England with Oliver Cromwell and Charles III.
Trapezoidal shaped coin?
Yeah.
No, this is brilliant.
Oh, these are great. This was made during the sieges between Cromwell and Charles I. Charles I had to pay his troops, but he didn't have any coins because he was under siege. So what did he do? He cut up the silver plate. He cut up the dishes, and then they stamped it and weighed it, and that's how they paid the troops.
Wow. But, I mean, you pay the troops. They can't go anywhere and spend it. Why don't you
Well, they can
say,
spend
hey,
it amongst themselves.
I suppose. Craps games.
Well, exactly. 17th century craps.
That is really cool. The number is 800-348-2551. David Tripp is here. We talk about coins with David. And then there's stamps. And, frankly, Bob has barely gotten a word in edgewise so far. Bob Scott, what's new in the stamp world?
Oh, what do we have? What do we have? Well, I think... David's, we're actually selling, or it's coming up for sale, potentially the first stamp ever made, which dates back to 1840. Unfortunately, it has a little bit of a few questions about it.
Now, wait, where was this? English?
It was English.
You've heard of the penny black, yes?
Yeah. And the first American stamp was 1847?
1847.
Yeah.
Yeah, well, the first general issue. But because these were printed, the first U.S. stamps were printed in sheets of 100, and the first British stamps were printed in sheets of 240, then the first stamp had to have 239 siblings purely by the fact that it was printed.
Bob's always been too detail-oriented.
But this was presented to the man who actually championed the development of the stamp right from the very, very, very beginning. And the stamp was presented to him by the Chancellor of the Exchequer, basically the guy in charge of the purse in Great Britain. And if this is not of that sort of significance, well, why would they make such a thing about presenting it to him? Because in a week's time, you could go to any post office in Britain and buy one for a penny. So this has to have significance, and there's probably a deal of validity attached to the story.
I mean,
4 to 6 million pounds.
Okay, 4 to 6 million pounds. There better be validity to the story.
One would hope so. I would think that...
Well, hasn't it been okayed by the major philatelic?
The Royal Philatelic Society and the British Philatelic Association have given it their blessing.
Well, those are some big words. Let's take a break while I digest it all. 800-348-2551 is the number. Stamps and coins today. David Tripp, Bob Scott. We'll get to your phone calls, your emails coming up. Junior Walker and the All-Stars as our bumper music here on Vox Pop. 800-348-2551. Every now and then I get the urge to do a little DJ work when I was at an oldies station. Junior Walker and the All-Stars here. WAMC. Bob Scott is here. He'll talk stamps with you. David Tripp is here. He'll talk coins with you. And I'll just answer the phones, and let's do that now. Ken in Albany. Ken, you're on.
Hey there. Bob Scott, are you? You're not the Scott of the Philatelist Bible, are you?
You know, it's an interesting thing. No, I am not. However, John Walter Scott, who was that Scott, was an Englishman that came to America in the 1880s. So there's a chance, but there's a lot of us Scots. And that's not even counting the ones that came from north of the border.
Right.
So, yes, I'm an Englishman that called Scott that came to do stamps, but we're 100 years apart.
Great, Scott.
And,
is that
probably the bank balance as well from publishing?
Quite likely. I don't know whether J.W. Scott actually made any money.
Ken, is there a question besides that?
Yep, there certainly is.
Okay.
I have recently, my parents were both avid philatelists. My mother was doing the internationals. My dad had a good collection of U.S. stamps. I never got into it at all, but they had been collecting for many years, and they're both passed away now, and my sister and I have inherited all of their materials, all the stamps. Most of the best ones, of course, are mounted in albums. Now, the family, I need to get them evaluated, and I'm not interested in continuing the collection. I would like to get bids on, know how much they're worth, is the first thing.
Right.
Now, I'm a bit paranoid about that because our family has been ripped off by a scrupulous collector before. He put an ad in the local Philatelist newsletter, and a couple of people came up to look at what he had, took away a list, and some guy came and he looked at the collection and took away a list, and then about two or three weeks later, they came home from work to find the door kicked in and the stamps gone.
Ouch. That's bad.
Oh, dear.
And, of course, he was a very trusting soul, and he brought me up that way, too. You trust anyone until they prove themselves unworthy.
Well, you told the whole story on the radio, Ken, so I hope you're very trusting.
He did not leave his number and address.
All right, that's a good point.
Well,
that is correct. I'm not about to either. So what my concern is, how can I safely get the collections evaluated? It's also got some, some proof sheets and, a bunch of additional things as well, and other collectible like art prints.
Right.
Someone who's not going to? I'm sorry.
Why don't you let me try and tell you? I'll try and explain something.
Oh,
you obviously know about the Scott catalog.
That's about it.
Right. Well, the Scott catalog is essentially, and if your parents were collecting, they would have had the Scott catalogs, and so you have access to. You have access to a priced catalog of everything that you have. And the first most important thing, if you want to ensure you're actually going to get value, is to go through the collection and ascertain as to whether you have anything of value. And this is the advice, this is the best advice I can give you, is just make note of anything that you have that has a Scott catalog value of over $100. If it's under $100, don't even consider it because it's a retail catalog and you are looking for a value that somebody's actually going to pay. And very, very few people are going to pay the full retail price.
Well, what's the markup?
The markup, anything. It can be 10 times, it can be 20 times. But until you get to 100...
Stamp catalog prices are mystical. I've looked at them for years. I have my little red book that we get every year, and those are actually based on real prices. I've looked at Bob's stamp catalogs. I'm telling you, the word mystified.
Oh, it is. It's mystified, but your world is pretty much the same. As a rule of thumb, just to give a guideline, and it may be a minimum price, is I take stamps that are catalogued for over $100, and I take about 10% of that value. So I'm saying that you get a $100 catalog value stamp, you should count it as $10. And then if you can get to a point where using that formula, you can get to beyond $500, then that's when you make a note of my, our email address and get in touch. And then I will direct you to the right person.
Well, that's very nice of you. And that's very nice of you to do. What is your email address while we're here and talking about it?
It's coin and stamp guys at Burke, B-E-R-K, .com. So coin and stamp guys, all spelled out, at Burke, B-E-R-K, .com.
Okay. And Ken, I guess Bob will try to send you in the right direction there. And good luck with the collection. 800-348-2551, the telephone number. It's Stamps and Coins today with David Tripp at Bob Scott. Eric is in Niskayuna. Hello, Eric. You're on.
Hey.
Hey, Eric. How are
you? Pretty much the same. Good. How are you guys doing?
Good.
I've got pretty much the same question, so I didn't. Get, I guess I should have been screened out. But, I mean, I'm talking, I've got my father's collection, and there are thousands of stamps.
Right.
So I have to go through pretty much every stamp.
Well, first of all, is it mostly used or unused?
They're a mixture of both. He was in World War II. He collected a lot of Nazi Germany stamps.
Okay.
Beautiful stamps.
Okay. The truth is, there's a value to stamps from Nazi Germany. But the thing is, as soon as the war ended, they became terribly unpopular. And the thing is, nobody actually threw them away. They all put them away. So even though some of them are slightly scarce, there is no shortage of them whatsoever. They exist in sheets, blocks. The one thing they don't exist, really, is used after the Second World War because nobody used them. It's the same with anything with a swastika on it after the Second World War became absolutely... Firstly, it was valueless. It was replaced very, very shortly afterwards. And secondly, nobody wanted to be reminded of it.
Exactly.
But I mean, the general arc of this conversation, Eric, and I must say, Bob does this almost to every stamp caller who calls in with a similar situation. I've got thousands of my grandfather's stamps. He'll say at the end of the conversation, "I'm sorry."
In some cases I do, but for general themes, you don't. If you have used stamps from 1940 onwards, the chances are they don't have very much value because they were printed in numbers of 20 million, 30 million, 100 million a throw. And unfortunately, that doesn't, like every commodity in this world, rarity is the thing that is above all else, and you really almost have to go back 100 years to get the rarity that you need.
Eric,
but
go ahead.
At one level, that rarity can easily exceed $1 million.
Yeah, well, that's the thing, and that's what you would hate the most if Grandpappy had 18,000 stamps and they were all worth less than a penny, and then there was that one that he got by mistake.
But the great thing about Grandpappy when he collected is collectors, they get their stamps, they like to identify them, and this would apply to Ken, the previous caller, as well. They put a stamp collector that comes across a $1,000 stamp, which to your average collector is an awful lot of money, does not just put it in the album and go to himself, "Ooh, that's worth $1,000. He writes, "This is a..."
Yeah, oh, you make
he
a point.
He puts a big underline. He puts it on its own special page.
You don't write directly on the stamp, though.
Right, or if he bought it, he makes a note of it.
Unless it's the British Guyana and everybody signs the back of it.
Oh, that's true.
No, that's right. Fortunately, they don't write the number that they paid for it, because otherwise there wouldn't be much real estate.
Well, no, and there are too many zeros on the back of that stamp.
David Tripp is here. Bob Scott is here. Stamps and Coins today, 800-348-2551, the number. Sam is in Troy. Sam, you're on.
Yes, thank you. Thank you, gentlemen.
Hi, Sam.
Just got a question. I'm curious. 3-4 years ago, there was a couple in California that claimed they found a bag of coins from the mint near a tree or something like that. Have you heard anything more about that?
I think you're referring to something that's called the Saddle Ridge Hoard, which was found in Northern California purportedly. And yes, it was a bag of $20 gold pieces from the mid-19th century. It's a strange thing. Nobody's quite figured out whether somebody just had a bag of coins and buried them in their backyard, which, you know, being honest, people didn't trust banks and people did bury, and that's why there are so many ancient coins and hoards like that. Another theory that emanated was that they were actually stolen from the mint, and the thief buried in the back because they were in very good shape. In any event, they were marketed. They have come to market. A dealer out in California had them and did a very elaborate write-up about them and investigated the story behind them. And, you know, some of them, he would sell them with the original coloring from being in the dirt. They've mostly filtered into the market. And, you know, there's stories sell, you know, that's the sizzle. And it's kind of like shipwreck coins. And generally when these things come up, first time around, like the SS Central America, which was this fabulous treasure ship, things bring a premium over that because you're buying the romance. Generally, that sort of settles down. And since these were never sold
at
auction,
after them?
Beg pardon?
I thought the mint went after them, said that they were stolen from them.
That was a different coin that the mint went after. That was the coins from Philadelphia that Ray's looking at right now.
That's the 1933
double eagle.
And you wrote a book about that.
That I wrote a book
about. Oh, okay.
And
I appreciate it, though.
And there were 10 and more that turned up after the coin was sold. It went through 11 years of litigation in which I was involved as the government's witness. The government prevailed. It went to the Supreme Court. And they are now in the property of the United States government. And there's only one that can be sold that was sold by Sotheby's in June of this year for $19 million.
Sam, thanks a lot. And why can that one be sold?
It was sent to King Farouk of Egypt. There is an export license that was issued by the United States government before they discovered they had been stolen from the mint.
So they were okay with it.
Exactly.
Initially. And King Farouk had an awful lot of oil.
Well, no, it had nothing to do with it because it wasn't Farouk's by the time it came to sale. It was the Egyptian government's.
All right. The number here
is Egypt does not have oil. They are one of the few countries in the Middle East that is oil-free.
I've lost track of the show here. Now it's about oil.
There we go.
800-348-2551 is our number. And let's go to the email bag for a moment here. This one is from Matt in Pittsfield. What do you know about a coin-finding contest, specifically quarters from the West Point Mint? I've never heard of anything like that.
A coin finding contest. That, I've got to be honest, that is one that skips my mind.
Well, you know,
West Point Mint.
Yes, there is a
mint. But it's got to limit the time.
Well, the West Point Mint and is generally only used for, they do mostly high value, the sort of gold eagles and things like that are issued. They deal with a lot of the gold there. But this is one I will be the first to admit. I will have to look it up, and the next time we get together, I've never heard of it.
I'm afraid I might know.
I
might know. I don't know about this specific one.
Okay.
But, okay, so
I'm learning something.
I think I've told you that my wife got me a metal detector for Christmas last year. Okay. And it's something now of an obsession. We'll go out, we'll find nails in the backyard, we call it a treasure. But the emails that come from the company that she bought the metal detector mention these detectorist weekends where you go and they will seed meadows with coins. And I think that's what our writer was talking about.
Oh, it's your golden ticket.
Okay. Good answer, right? This email from Paul. I like to have fun spending Eisenhower dollars, especially at small businesses and farmers markets. I always ask for them when I go to the bank, and one out of every 10 visits, I'm able to get one or two. I'm not looking for anything fancy. I just want to find out where can I get Eisenhower dollars without paying extra. And that's from Paul.
I would say good luck to you.
Really?
It is so difficult. Kennedy half dollars, Eisenhower dollars, the banks don't like to handle them because people are distrustful of them. You can try and order them from the mint directly, but that can be a nightmare if you want to get it at face value, because the government builds in profits.
Kennedy halves, you always used to get at casinos.
Maybe go to Vegas. Maybe they've got some.
I think they've stopped doing that.
That's the thing. It's all chips now.
Yeah,
it's their own product.
It's all just electronic now.
And they do exist. It's like I had somebody contacted me. They wanted to get a bag of Susan B. Anthony dollars, which the government has in plentitude because no one wanted them. Try and get them, and the government's got them, but you can't get them.
That's interesting.
Give a call to the Federal Reserve Bank because they're in charge of distribution.
And leave a message.
There you go.
There you go. Bob Scott, David Tripp, join us. Stamps and coins today. One more email and then back to the phones. This one's from Barbara. I have two $1 copper coins from the year 2000. Do they have any value?
2,000 copper coins. So they're probably the Sacagawea dollars. And they were called golden. Spend them. Basically, unless they are in absolutely pristine condition.
There are no rarities or any kind of
imperfections? There are minor, I can look up, there are many minor imperfections in anything. But for the most part, without seeing it, the time spent, this is one where the time spent looking for what's wrong with it is, you know, there is the Cheerios version and the, because they issued some and then
Cheerios?
Yes, they were packaged in boxes of Cheerios.
Can I remember that?
Yeah.
A Count Chocula dollar?
Isn't it sad? Because rather, if it had been Eisenhower dollars rather than Sacagawea dollars, you could have had two calls that would have canceled, two emails which would have canceled.
Oh, that's a good point.
So I'm looking at the Red Book, and just to give you an idea, in mint condition, there is one variety that has detailed tail feathers. And if you have the detailed tail feathers, that's worth a couple of grand.
Ah.
Yeah.
All right, okay. So look
closely. So you've got to look for your detailed, but you have to have one that doesn't have the detailed tail feathers to be able to compare the two.
You make a point. I mean, is it great but detail? I mean, will you say, wow, look at the detail?
As opposed to a fan, you're going to see a fan where you can see all the ribs.
Okay. Well, I hope that helps our writer. 800-348-2551 if you want to call in and ask a question of Bob Scott and David Tripp. Lori is in Lanesboro. Lori, you're on.
Yes. My mother, who's in her 80s, has a Ducks Unlimited collection of stamps that she got from her brother, who was an avid hunter. And knowing nothing at all about them, could you speak to anything you might know about them, like for selling them, or we don't quite know what to do with them. Some are in, you know, those plastic, thin plastic containers.
Yes.
Some are on paper with pictures that go along with the duck on the stamp,
right.
And just if you could talk to that, that'd be great.
Okay.
These ducks, they're stamps used for hunting permits, so they originate from duck hunting stamps. Date is critical. Do you know what the earliest date is?
I'm not at her house right now, so I don't know. But he had them, you know, for a number, you know, he collected them, and I'm not sure of dates.
So how old would he have been, and how old would he have been, and was he a hunter?
He was born in 1932 or 1934, so.
Well, the collection would have to come from would have had to have been started by an earlier relative, because the duck hunting permit started circa 1934. Would have been a bit too young for him. But and the true value, unless there are some errors involved, really are limited to the first 5 years. So from about 1934 to, say, 1940, when people didn't collect them, they just used them. And you cancel them yourself by signing your own hunting permit. You have new versions. You have used and you have unused. Obviously, it was quite a lot of money back then. Go and check your dates. If they don't start until 1950 or so, yes, it'll have a nominal value of maybe $100, maybe a few hundred dollars, possibly a little bit less. But if they have the early ones, then there is some value there. This is probably at some point when you take down the email address, and if you give me an idea of the dates, and I will let you know more.
Yeah, and the date is found on the stamp?
No, it's got every single one of them has an expiry date on them. Because they're hunting permits, and every year they were issued for 1 year, they expire on X next year, and you have to go and buy another one.
Lori, thanks for the call. We got to take a break here. David Tripp and Bob Scott join us to talk stamps and coins. We'll be back at 800-348-2551. We'll be right back. Vox Pop on WAMC. Ray Graff here. 800-348-2551 is the telephone number. The email address is voxpop@wamc.org. Karen writes, for your caller who wanted $1 coins, go to the New York City subway, buy a MetroCard at a machine. The change will be in dollar coins.
But they will probably be small dollar coins that fit in the machines, not Eisenhower's.
Well, you make a point.
You'll get Sacagawea's, what you used to quite recently.
Before we get to our next call, we're just having a conversation off the air during the break. And the last time you guys were on, I guess it was over the phone. I mean,
yeah,
it's so funny. When people are on the phone, I remember back and say, oh, they were here. It's just my memory playing tricks on me because we are talking. But the last time we were here, you were talking about how stamp and coin collecting, which had been at kind of a low point for a while, really picked up during the COVID.
Oh, absolutely. People didn't have anything better to do, I guess.
They
played on the internet, and stuff started moving. And we're not talking about the trillion-dollar coins and the zippy-dippy stamps.
No, we're talking about the, you know, $10, $20, $30, $50 mark. Because stamps and coins at the basic level has transferred seamlessly to the internet.
Yeah.
So people who were sitting at home, had nothing better to do, were going stir crazy.
Right.
Looked at their stamp books, their coin books, and went, what are they? Oh, okay. And they went back to a market where they may have been jaded at some point because things were expensive. But all of a sudden, you've got the internet, which gave you choice. And a very, very easy way to while away many hours that all of us have spent over the last couple of years.
And $25 coins 2 years ago have now gone up to $40 to $50.
That's amazing. That's great.
I mean, it's wonderful. And it's getting more people involved. And the interesting thing is because it's on the internet, a lot of the younger generation, the techies, are getting into it as well. So we're starting to see a burgeoning new generation into the collecting area. And once they've hit the entry point, then we...
Yes, it's a rabbit hole. Indeed.
Well, you know, Bob and I have been down that rabbit hole for too many years.
Well, you've made a good living. 800-348-2551 is the number. David Tripp and Bob Scott are here to answer your questions. Fred is in Cohoes. Fred.
Hi, Ray. I have a question about counterfeit compared to non-counterfeit stamps.
Sure.
My grandfather was a missionary in Brazil and India from the late 1800s to the mid-1930s, had acquaintances, friends all over the world, left us with a large, quite a bit of it, uncataloged collection that I showed some samples to a stamp place down in New York City a number of years ago.
Yeah.
And he said, well, probably most of the collection is counterfeit because if your grandfather was a missionary, he wouldn't be able to afford real stamps. Well, most of the collection weren't what he bought. They were what were sent to him.
Right.
I was going to say, in a quiet moment, you can tell me who you went to go and see. I don't think we should do any. I don't think we should do any public shaming. Or, you know, there's a very good.
Right,
there's always
right.
the chance I might say, well, he actually knows what he's talking about.
Right.
There is no correlation to that. The whole point of, you know, the greatest missionary stamps of all were the stamps that were issued in Hawaii in the 1850s that were sent back by some missionaries to their relatives in Connecticut. And if you have one of those particular envelopes, well, the last time it sold, and that was a long time ago, was $2.1 million.
Yay, wow.
So this, and trust me, the guy didn't have any money. But how much money do you need to actually go to a post office and spend 2 cents on a stamp?
Yeah.
So the notion of that is somewhat ridiculous. Go ahead.
I'm sorry. I was just going to say one box of uncataloged stamps is marked in my grandfather's handwriting. Do not get rid of valuable stamps in this box.
Oh, okay. Well, it's good. I mean, you could have said tin and just made it completely amusing.
Yeah.
Well, obviously, it's something that you can take a photograph of and we will have a little bit of a look. You know, the chances, there are always chances. by 1880, all the earliest stamps had been issued, all the great classics, but there were still some really good things out there. But also by 1880, people were forging stamps, although we didn't call them forgeries. We called them, in some cases, reprints. In some cases, they were. Well, because people, even back then, when it was so popular, people couldn't get hold of these really valuable ones, so they wanted facsimiles. And facsimile is better than fake, and many companies legitimately sold these reproductions.
Well, why on earth would a collector buy a facsimile of a valuable stamp?
Because you can't afford the real one.
And the whole point is, you've got to fit, if you've got an album, you've got to fill in all the gaps.
Yep.
So, so take a note of the email address, send me a picture.
All right, what is that
I will
email
give
address?
You a decent... The email, and we will talk about it the next time.
It's Coin and Stamp Guys, spelled out, at Berk.com.
You know, Bob Scott, this is amazing. First stamp, 1840.
Yes.
By 1880, they were counterfeiting stamps.
They absolutely
That's incredible.
Were. Yeah, but the funniest thing is, in 1880, they were counterfeiting them. But for the clever counterfeiters, the ones that were not doing it just to sell facsimiles, the ones that were actually defrauding post offices, some of these scams weren't discovered until 60 years later.
Are any of those counterfeits worth money?
Oh, yeah. In some cases, they're worth more than the originals.
Didn't Sotheby's in London many years ago have a sale?
The Stock Exchange forgeries.
Very specialized collection.
When you bought a stock back in the days, you had to pay a stamp tax on it. They used a particular stamp and they cancelled them, and it paid these fees, and it came to tens of thousands of pounds. Well, this, all these stamps that were used and cancelled on these stock exchange receipts were all kept. A stamp dealer in the 1940s, 60 years later, goes through them and says, these are fakes.
Wow. It took that long.
And quite obvious fakes. But somebody walked off with... They've done research. They've researched the DNA of the saliva of the people that licked them.
That's another show. Let's go to Jay in Albany. Jay, you're on.
Oh, hi. How are you today?
Hi, Jay.
Hello.
One thing about Eisenhower dollars, every so often you can get them for a dollar a piece if they have a few at the bank.
That's exactly. That's what the previous caller was saying. You've got to just be lucky and be determined.
Right. And as far as Kennedy halves go, it's almost impossible to get a roll anymore to help fill out my album. What I actually was calling about, though, was I've recently seen advertisements in the Times Union for rolls of Standing Liberty halves. And what do you know about the...
Well, the Standing Liberty half dollar is one of the classic designs. It was designed by Adolph Weinmann, as you probably know, and who was a student of Augustus St. Gaudens. And they were issued between, if memory serves, between 1916 and 1947, when the Franklin dollar came in. And they exist, and they're wonderful. They're still great designs, and dealers buy them up and trade them, and then they sell them. I don't know what prices are being asked in the Times Union ad, but that's one of the things. I mean, dealer to dealer, a roll of them in sort of good condition, which is really pretty worn, is around $200. That's sort of a wholesale price dealer to dealer. So that gives you an idea of what kind of markup they're asking.
Right. Yeah, I was wondering if it was a good deal, if there was even legitimate. I know the ones I've got in my album are pretty well worn.
Right. Well, but again, it's dates and so forth. If you have 1921 D&S, that's a key date. That's a great date to have, and that'll be worth a few hundred bucks.
Jay, thanks a lot for the call.
Thank you.
You know, we're talking about counterfeits, and we also have talked about the internet and the proliferation of collectors out there who are maybe new to the hobby, and the internet is a great boon, but it can also have dangers. How would one with only limited knowledge of coins or stamps protect themselves from buying something that is completely bogus on an auction site?
Yeah, that is one of the great problems.
First rule, if it looks too good.
It is too good. I mean, that's the bottom line. But the thing is, forgers have become increasingly sophisticated. You need to do your research, find out who the seller is. You see this on coin sites all the time. They will have dealers, I say, on eBay. That's a fake. We've gotten in touch with eBay to take it down. And there are a lot of people in the trade that really do self-policing.
And eBay itself pays people to keep an eye.
Yeah. Interesting.
Yeah. But the knowledge is your best thing. If it's in a slab, one of these third-party grading services, NGC and PCGS are the two primary places. That is your first good determinant that it is genuine. Problem is, they're now faking the slabs. One step ahead.
George in Hackensack. George, you're on.
Hi, I'd just like to ask your guest, is there any thought, talk, or schedule of eliminating the U.S. cent?
Always.
Canada, I only just learned this. Canada got rid of theirs seven and a half years ago.
Well,
I never knew. So
You didn't miss it.
Makes sense.
There is constant, and I repeat, constant discussions, because it costs more than a penny to make a penny, basically, to make a cent. The nickel and the cent are both loss leaders for the government. Because of inflationary pressures, there's constant hot air. There are political interests involved that make the metal, and it goes back and forth. Collectors love it because it's one of the most heavily collected things. So the collecting body is out there wanting them. And so for the time being, to the best of my knowledge and from the buddies I know at the Mint, there is no indication that it's going anywhere away tomorrow.
George, thank you very much for the call. Now, if they did go away, does that increase the value of the more mundane issues in years
eventually
previous?
But you've got to remember that we're talking hundreds of billions. I'm cheating here, everybody.
Yep.
I am looking in the Red Book, and I'm just going to very, very quickly tell you.
$2 billion a year.
Okay. So 2011, $2,176,940,000 were made.
Wow.
And replace all those that went into the jars.
And that was just at the Denver Mint in Philadelphia. They made an additional $2 billion. So those coins are never really going to be valuable unless they're in absolutely pristine condition, put into slabs, and then maybe they're going to be worth $4 to $6.
They're mostly zinc now, right?
They're mostly zinc now. But the thing is that the earlier ones, yes. And we were talking about how the market's going. Lincoln pennies that every kid started with, going through his pocket looking at a Lincoln cent. Some of the prices on these things are insane.
Really?
Insane. I feel like Crazy Eddie.
When did they stop using primarily copper in those?
I believe that was 1960.
It's 63, 64.
Yeah.
Okay. Our number here is 800-348-2551. Back to the phones. Joe in Shelburne, Mass. Joe, you're on.
Yeah, hi, Ray. Hi, thanks for taking my call.
You bet.
Bob and Dave, thank you as well.
Hi, Jeff.
I have a red 1 cent George Washington stamp that has been mailed.
Yes.
And it is still on the envelope.
Yep.
I believe it was mailed sometime in the 50s, but I'm not sure.
Yep.
I'm not looking at it. Is there anything you can tell me about it? Is it worth anything?
It's a standard. It would be a standard definitive. You say 1 cent. Is it on a card or is it on an envelope? Because it's either a standard postcard rate or it's a second-class envelope.
You said an envelope.
Yes.
Yeah, it's on an envelope.
Right. It's I'm not sure. It's as regular as probably the mail you received this morning. Very, very, very common.
Okay.
Only it probably took a lot less time to deliver than the letter you got.
No, that's the second shot you've taken at the delivery service.
Well, David summed it up, because what should be the new adage?
Well, you have a forever stamp because that's how long it takes to get to you.
That's mean. I'm going to go to the next caller. That's terrible. And we go to Mike in Del Mar. Mike, you're on.
Thank you, Ray, and thank you guys for it's very entertaining, actually. Quick question.
You sound surprised.
I have a two-fold question.
Yeah. Two questions, and one crosses stamps and coins. I have, when I was a kid, several first day of issue $2 bills when they came out, and I went to our post office and had stamps affixed to them, and I've held them now since whenever they came out, and I was just wondering if they had any value.
76?
1976, yeah. That was it was a bicentennial.
Yeah, yeah. Well, okay.
Yeah, yeah. And and you can still, just for the, well, at least you used to, the one place you could get a $2 bill in change was in the gift shop at Monticello.
Oh, really?
Yeah, exactly.
I used to love those $2 bills.
Yeah, they're fabulous. And the problem is that too many people didn't realize they were $2 and used them as a $1 bill, and so they lost 50%.
They're still in circulation, though,
yeah,
right?
Yeah, absolutely. Absolutely, but you don't hardly ever
see
them.
So, Mike,
worth anything?
You put stamps on them? Is that common, Bob?
Yep.
But
it was a commemorative.
Yes, everything from the bicentennial in 76, whether it involved a coin, a banknote, or what have you, just because it was a way of affixing a specific date to it. And a postal cancellation was brilliant. So you put a stamp on a banknote, put a stamp on a card, put a stamp on... You could put a stamp almost because they created miniature sheets
anything.
for the bicentennial.
Yeah.
So, yeah, they all got stamped. None of us is going to live long enough to see the bicentennial material get to the point of scarcity, because literally we were drowning in it in 1960.
Yes, we were.
Well, and the 250 is literally just around the corner.
Go ahead, Mike. We got a minute left. Go ahead, Mike.
Oh, and then a secondary question. This is more a general question. I have several hundred half dollars, the Walking Liberty type, the Franklins, and also several silver dollars that I'm at the point in my life where I'd like to sell them. What strategy or guidance would you suggest to a coin collector who
wants to walk into
a store and do the best you can and get as much as you can from the buyer?
Well, that does make sense. The first thing to do is go to the library, get yourself a red book, check it out, look to see if you have any dates that are rarer than not. And
I've done that.
You've done that. Yes. Nothing rare?
Yep.
You've got something.
1893S Morgan dollar, for example.
That's an extremely rare coin. That is the key coin. An example of that in perfect condition was recently sold for $2
million. Oh, that's a good one.
So the point is that with a lot of these coins, if they are better, you will be benefit if you do get them to one of these grading services. And then it's... At that point, it's almost like selling a commodity. If it's an VFX, it's a EFY. You can get a value very, very easily and figure it out, and then you can do your bargaining that way.
Mike, thanks a lot for the call. Mike. And you actually got David Tripp's eyebrow to raise, which I think is the first time in the program today with the, 1893S?
93S. That's the key date.
Guys, once again, what's your email address?
It's coinandstampguys, all spelled out. At Berk, BERK.com.
All right. Well, thank you both for being here. Great to have you back in the studio. Support comes from Paws Gallery, Troy, New York. Open late Friday the 26th for Troy Night Out, and open early November 27th for Small Business Saturday. PawsGallery.com. And East Branch Studio, now featuring East Branch Homes, a new division of hybrid prefab homes that are net zero ready and low in embodied carbon, traditional to modern styles available. EastBranchHomes.com. Once again, thanks to Bob Scott and David Tripp for being here. Thank you for listening. Thanks for the calls. Thanks for the emails. Thanks to Zach Malloy, our engineer. Phone screened today by Amber Sickles. I'm Ray Graff. Tomorrow, another rousing edition of Pets and Vets. We'll welcome back Dr. Ron Scharf to answer your questions. Right now, stand by for something wonderful.